At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
On the program today, the economic nuts and bolts, of course. Then, though, the bathroomification of America and Valentine's Day, toddler style. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is the 14th of February today. Good as always to have you along, everybody. This being a Friday, we are going to do what we do at the end of a week. Take a look back and say, huh, so that happened. Gina Smilek's at the New York Times. Heather Long is with the Washington Post. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
So, Gina, can I start with you, please? And going back to Tuesday, Wednesday this week, Fed Chair Jay Powell goes to Capitol Hill, does his twice-a-year testimony. A couple of things I want to touch on. Number one, he's a little bit concerned about the coronavirus. It was interesting. He's keeping an eye on it. Don't know what's going to happen yet, but it's on his mind.
Yeah, you know, the poor Fed, they just spent all of 2019 waiting for this trade war to get resolved. We see a little bit of glimmer of hope on the horizon, and along comes the coronavirus. So obviously, there are other victims of the coronavirus who we should be crying for a lot more. But the Fed is, you know, really facing a challenging situation here where it's just impossible to assess at this point what the effects of this virus are going to be economically. And so Chair Powell got up on the Hill this week and said repeatedly, you know, what we're really watching is to see how this affects the U.S. economy. And we know it's going to affect China's economy. We expect it to affect the U.S. economy to some extent, just not clear at all at this point how big that effect is going to be.
Heather, there's a trickle-down thing going on here, right? Not in the supply-side economic sense, but in the idea that the world's biggest manufacturing economy, the Chinese economy, has been shut down now basically for a number of weeks. The IMF came out and said, yeah, we're worried about this. I know I've used this before and not everybody's bought into it, but it's that black swan that nobody saw coming at the end of a very long expansion.
That's absolutely right. We were supposed to see a number of Chinese factories reopen this week. February 10th was that day everyone had circled on their calendar, and that just didn't happen. So I think heading into this week, the sort of consensus estimate was that global growth would be hurt by this by about half a percentage point. So going from about 3% down to 2.5. But at the end of this week, I'd say those estimates are getting cut further and further. So the Capital Economics even said we could possibly see negative growth in the first quarter for the global economy. That hasn't happened since 2009.
Wow. And that nobody likes mentioning 2009. That's a fact. Gina, one more thing the Fed chair talked about a little bit, a lot actually, was debt and deficits. And he's concerned. I think that's the general state of play with Jay Powell. He's concerned.
He's concerned. He's very concerned. Yeah. And I think, you know, debt and deficits are just the federal deficit and the federal debt are something that he just comes back to all the time. This is a real pet topic of his. But he's just worried that, you know, given that deficits are so large right now and given that the national debt is so significant, that there won't be enough fiscal space come a recession. Now, he's always very careful to say that we're not there yet. We're not out of space. There is space, et cetera, et cetera. But he's always warning about the future. You know, if the United States got its financial house in order now, his reasoning goes, you know, there would be more room down the road for Congress to really step it up if growth turns lower.
So, Heather, let me actually just pick up on that and talk about the possible remedies if and when a recession comes, right? Because the Fed now has interest rates extremely low. Congress is not of a mind to do almost anything in a collaborative nature. Troubling or not troubling?
It's hugely troubling, and that's why Jay Powell used his precious moments before Congress to try to tell them to get their fiscal house in order here. I thought it was also interesting this week that he was asked this question, and he once again reiterated that he doesn't want to do negative interest rates, that if the United States hits a road bump, hits a downturn, that he would be willing to cut those interest rates pretty quickly back to zero, and he would be willing to do what we saw in the last crisis where they pump money into the economy and they buy a lot of bonds, but he was a no on negative interest rates.
I think that's totally interesting because Ben Bernanke two chairs ago said, you know, a number of weeks and or months ago, you know, the Fed ought to maintain constructive ambiguity on negative rates. So I just, the guy in the seat now is like, yeah, no, we're not doing that. Speaking of people on the Fed, Gina, I want to ask you about a hearing this week, confirmation hearing for a woman by the name of Judith Shelton to be a member of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve. It did not go well for Dr. Shelton, for Ms. Shelton. Explain to us why, please.
Right, unless you ask the White House, in which case it did go well. But, yeah. No, it was one of the more electric hearings that I've ever watched on Capitol Hill. You know, Judy Shelton has a record of backing some pretty out-of-the-mainstream economic ideas. She's been a big advocate for the gold standard. She has a history of writing about sort of, you know, at times the futility of the Fed and the problems with quantitative easing and lower interest rates, et cetera. She's reversed a lot of those positions since President Trump came into office, and she's kind of backed away from the gold standard stuff as well. And so a lot of this hearing was just kind of vetting her record on those topics and then questioning her ability to be independent of the White House if she were confirmed to the Fed. And at the conclusion of it, it seemed like several of the Republican senators were just not convinced that she is an appropriate pick for the Fed board. And so her nomination looks pretty severely imperiled at this point.
Heather, I hate to do this to you, your first time on the program and on live radio, but you got 45 seconds to answer this question. This is now the third nominee from the president to run into some trouble for appearing to be politically convenient, Herman Cain and Stephen Moore and now Ms. Shelton. It's worth a note, right?
I think it's incredibly telling when you have key Republican senators walking out of the Senate Banking Committee, stopping to tell reporters that they have serious concerns about a Trump nominee and that literally calling her an outlier. So this is a pretty big red line that they are drawing, that they are not, that they want to keep the Fed independent and apolitical, one of the last institutions. Basically, they don't want the Fed to turn into the Supreme Court, and that's good for America.
Heather Long at The Washington Post, Gina Smilek at The New York Times. Thanks, you two.
Thanks,
Scott. Thank
you. Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street today, flat finish to an up week. Details, numbers, when we get there. There was some slightly sobering news on the consumer front today, the all-important consumer front, I ought to say. Retail sales were basically flat in January, technically up, but just by a hair. December sales were revised down. Digging in just a little bit to the clothing and clothing accessories category, sales off 3.1%, the biggest drop in 10 years. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour has more on what happened there.
Why was January so wretched? Partly because the weather wasn't.
The northeastern half of the United States in January seems to have had surprisingly mild weather, which would have had an effect on clothing sales.
Mark Cohen directs retail studies at Columbia Business School. In January, you're not out shopping for Christmas, you're not shopping for Hanukkah, you're not even shopping for spring yet. You're probably shopping for winter clothes because it's cold, unless it isn't. James Boniker is with IHS, and he says the other issue here is that people had already done an awful lot of shopping in December.
You know, for clothing especially, we saw a very strong gain in clothing sales in December, and then we got the payback from that in January.
And for that matter, stores had been throwing bargains at people all year long. David Swartz is a stock analyst with Morningstar Research.
I think the problem is that the discounting has become almost full-time. There's very little periods of the year now where there aren't lots of discounts.
So all in all, people were a little shopped out by January. If you compare this January to last January, clothing sales were basically flat. And there's a bigger picture behind that.
the economy has slowed down a bit over the past year. And perhaps this indicates that it's slowing down even more.
And a lot of department stores and clothing retailers have had troubles of their own. Macy's is closing more than 100 stores. Forever 21 went bankrupt. Again, James Boniker with IHS.
They're struggling with the rise of e-commerce and competing with that. That's one of the primary long-run trends that a lot of apparel retailers are struggling to compete with.
Clothing stores are just not living their best lives right now. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Delta Airlines, the world's biggest airline by revenue, by the way, said today it is going to spend $1 billion over the next decade to go carbon neutral. Not that its planes won't still be putting out greenhouse gases, but that it's going to mitigate all of those emissions in part by buying things that are called carbon offsets. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino explains that slice of the carbon economy.
There are a couple ways air travel could get cleaner, says Sola Jen with the International Council on Clean Transportation.
One is alternative jet fuel and the other is electrification.
But those technologies are years, maybe decades away from powering commercial planes. So Delta and other airlines have to look elsewhere to reduce their carbon footprints now by buying carbon offsets.
It's sort of a tool for someone who can't reduce emissions themselves to pay someone else to do it.
Jason Bordoff directs Columbia University's Center on Global Energy Policy.
If you were to plant trees that wouldn't otherwise be there, you'll remove CO2 from the air. If you can prevent trees from being cut down that might otherwise have been cut down, you can keep carbon from going into the air.
He says there are lots of programs to offset greenhouse gases, like investments in wind and solar farms and cleaner burning chimney designs. But the key is that they have to result in a permanent CO2 reduction that wouldn't have happened otherwise. Ethan Elkind directs the climate program at UC Berkeley School of Law.
Would this forest truly have been cut down without that carbon offset? That's a difficult question to answer.
Elkind says that's why offset programs need outside auditors to verify the actual carbon reductions. But there's also concern that focusing too much on offsets could slow clean tech advances.
So it really needs to be a whole suite of measures, and we don't want to let carbon offsets become an excuse for not doing the other things that we should be doing at the same time.
Things like cleaner airplanes or alternatives like high-speed rail. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
It needs not be said, I believe, that we are all spending more time getting to and from work. The Census Bureau says the average commute now is just north of 27 minutes, a new high. And it's happening because in a lot of places, people can't afford to live where or even near where they work. Marketplace's Amy Scott covers housing for us. She has been looking into what commute time means for teachers in one of this country's most expensive housing markets, and also what it means for the schools those teachers serve.
All right, let's get your hat.
It's the end of another day at Garfield Ready? Elementary in southeast Washington, D.C., and Claire Battle is zipping her 3- and 4-year-old pre-K students into their parkas to head outside.
To the bus, to the bus, to the bus.
Okay.
To the bus.
To the bus. Come on, Zamir, to the bus, to the bus.
Then Battle heads to the car, to the car, to the car for her commute home. She lives in Alexandria, Virginia, a suburb of D.C. With a stop to pick up her own 3-year-old son at daycare, it'll take about an hour if traffic cooperates.
I joke with people, I always go to the bathroom right before I get in the car because I never know how long I'm going to be in the car.
Battle would love to live closer to her school, but while D.C. has among the highest paid teachers in the country, it's also among the most expensive places to live. Scott Goldstein taught in the district for 10 years before starting the teacher advocacy group Empower Ed. He says D.C. schools have the highest teacher turnover in the country, partly because of the cost of living.
And that especially affects our ability to recruit and retain teachers of color, many of whom come out of college with much larger college debt.
Teachers aren't the only ones who pay a price. Research shows students of color do much better in school when their teachers look like them. And more than 80% of D.C. public school students are Black or Hispanic. Goldstein says for teachers,
to be able to stay in D.C., to teach in D.C. over a protracted period of time, which is what we really want and need, the housing costs are a real barrier for them.
To that end, the district has joined forces with a startup called Landed. It's helped more than 300 teachers buy homes in other expensive cities like San Francisco and Denver. Landed loans teachers up to $120,000 toward a down payment. When the house is sold, the company takes 25% of any profit or loss, plus the cost of the loan. Cheryl Williams would like to take advantage of a program like that. She's a teacher's aide at the same school as Claire Battle, with the same hour-long commute. Only Williams lives in Maryland. She's been saving up to buy a house closer in for 3 years, bartending at night and going to school online. But she says,
even with the down payment assistance in D.C., I wouldn't be able to, based on my income, what I'm making, I wouldn't be able to afford a house in D.C. even if they matched.
All right, let's go, Leo.
About 30 minutes into Battle's drive home, we pick up her son, Leo. She digs a squashed cereal bar out of her bag and passes it to the back seat.
It's all crumbly. You got it? Okay.
Battle has looked into Landed, too, but is wary of giving up so much equity. Still, she knows the value of living close to her school. When she first started teaching, she was having trouble connecting with some of her fifth graders. Then she ran into one of them at the grocery store.
You know those tabloid magazines that are like stars, like they're just like us? I feel like it was that moment, like teachers, they buy toothbrushes. So it helps to build relationships.
Relationships that are harder to make when staying just an hour later to meet with students or parents can add 20 minutes to her commute.
I've been at Garfield for 6 years, but there is a level of like, well, she doesn't live here. She doesn't know what it's like to live here.
At 4:33, we pull up to her complex, right on schedule. She and Leo head up the steps to their cozy two-bedroom apartment.
We love it here. If our family wasn't growing, we'd probably, you know, consider staying here.
But Battle is expecting a baby in May. So when the lease is up, they'll have to decide whether to rent a bigger place or buy a house, likely even farther away from her school. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Put it all together, and you have a kind of perfect storm for the bathroomification of America.
I warned y'all that was coming, didn't I? First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off 25 points today, almost a 10% on the downside, closed at 29,398 at the blue chips. The NASDAQ picked up 19 points, 0.2%, 97.31. The S&P 500 up 6, 0.1%, 33.80 there. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow brought home 1%, the NASDAQ accelerated 2.2%, the S&P 500 gained 1.5%. Megan was talking about Delta going carbon neutral. Stock nosed down 0.3% today. Kraft Heinz dripped down 3.2% after the ratings agency Fitch downgraded the company's bonds to junk. U.S. bonds, the government kind, prices rose. That means the yield goes down. Yield on the 10-year Treasury fell to 1.58%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey, it's Molly Wood. So the most important rule in corporate governance for the past half century has been prioritize shareholders and profit at all costs. But in today's climate, literally with global warming and extreme income inequality, people aren't having it.
There's definitely a strong public opinion that business needs to do better. So the notion of stakeholder capitalism is that corporations don't exist just for shareholders. They need to be good citizens and not purely focused on creating shareholder value.
Make Me Smart is the podcast where Kai Ryssdal and I talk about tech, the economy, and culture. This week, we dig into stakeholder capitalism and whether corporations are serious about making change. Subscribe to Make Me Smart wherever you listen to podcasts.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by public investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with public investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither public investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling shipping supplies or promoting productivity programs, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Valentine's Day spending in this country is expected to hit a record high this year, almost $28 billion. That's according to the National Retail Federation. 7% of that, almost $2 billion, again, that's from the NRF, is going to children's classmates. That's the actual category. Rukmini Kalamaki is a foreign correspondent for the New York Times who tweeted out her Valentine's Day experience the other day as a new mom.
Tweet one, Adventures in American Parenting. My son's daycare sent him home with a list of the other babies in his class entitled For Valentine's Day. My son, just so you know, can't yet speak, much less write, so the implication is that I, his mom, will fill out cards for a bunch of babies, all under the age of one. Tweet 2. My first reaction was, aw, how cute. My second was the revolted immigrant Rukmini, one whose mom never helped me with my own homework, and who once, just once, showed up to my cross-country meet, embarrassing me so thoroughly by running after me with a liter of Evian, I asked her not to come back. Tweet 3. For most of elementary and high school, I was mortified by how my immigrant family just couldn't get with the program. For example, trying to give trick-or-treaters $1 bills, like the kids were strippers or something. When I insisted it had to be candy, my family tried placing sticky cupcakes in their pumpkins. Tweet 4. So I guess I'd be setting up my son for a future tweet storm not unlike this one. 18 years from now, mind you, when he gets his first phone, if I don't buy the cards and spend Thursday night filling them out and signing the name of a 9-month-old boy. Tweet 5. Upon reflection, I've answered my own question. Get with the program, Rukmini. There's going to be hell to pay if my baby doesn't come home Friday with 20 similarly cute cards addressed to him in the name of 20 other babies, ghostwritten by their equally overworked parents.
Rukmini Kalamaki from the New York Times. You can follow her on Twitter at rkalamaki. Also read her stuff in the Times. It's amazing. An update, by the way, since this thread, Rukmini said ghostwriting those Valentines with her husband was actually pretty fun. As of airtime, though, we do not yet know the reciprocal Valentine's situation. If you see a tweet thread you think we might be interested in, let us know. I'm at Kai Rizdahl on Twitter. The show is at Marketplace. If you've ever been in the market for a house or looked for an apartment, you've probably paid attention to the square footage of said property, maybe the niceties of the kitchen as well, but you have almost certainly looked hard at the number of bathrooms. No finger pointing. We've all been there. But it turns out the American focus on bathrooms may be decidedly American. Derek Thompson is a staff writer at The Atlantic who had a story the other day titled America is Overrun with Bathrooms. Derek, it's good to have you on.
Great to be here.
So before we get to the current state of play with bathrooms in America, let's do some history. We were not, as you say, always as profusely bathroomed as we are today.
No, it was only in the 19th century that a group of wrong sanitarians thought that it was necessary to combine the three common fixtures of the modern bathroom, the tub, the sink, and the toilet. And they wanted to combine them in one well-ventilated room because they were afraid that the sewer gas was making people sick. But it turned out in the later 19th century, early 20th century, that they were wrong about the sewer gas theory. So actually, you could bring that three-fixture bathroom really, really close to the bedroom. And it's then, in the early 20th, mid-20th century, that the modern bathroom craze in America really took off. Since the 1960s, the number of bathrooms per American has doubled. And since the early 2000s, since we live in a modern gilded age, the share of homes with 10-plus bathrooms has doubled.
Amazing.
So we truly live in a, as you said, profusely bathroomed nation.
How come? Let's put on our economist hat here and talk about incentives and how this has come to pass, other than us just wanting more bathrooms because we can.
So first, it's land. America is just a lot bigger than a lot of other similarly rich countries. Our houses are about twice the size on average than houses in the EU, so there's just more room to wash up. Number two, the U.S. has, since the middle of the 20th century, passed a lot of laws to allow and even encourage the construction of larger homes. We not only have all of the zoning regulations for single home development in the suburbs across America, but we also have the mortgage interest deduction, which encourages people to buy more house because they'll get more of that mortgage back in their tax bill. Number three, I think, is psychology. I think that for the last really 50 years or maybe 100 years, Americans have become obsessed with privacy. And the more privacy you can buy, the more rich your life seems. And really, what is more private than the space behind a locked bathroom door? So you put it all together and you have a kind of perfect storm for the bathroomification of America.
Interesting that we're buying privacy in even within our own homes. And I don't know what that says about us as a society, but that's a whole different interview. I always thought that kitchen remodels were the thing that gave you the most bang for your buck when you're fixing up your house. Not so.
So I called Zillow and I talked to their economists about my theories about bathrooms in America, and they told me this amazing stat. They said that a simple bathroom remodel, that means replacing the toilet or adding a double sink, that carries the best bang for buck of any home renovation you can possibly do. $1.71 for every $1 spent. That's three times more effective than a kitchen renovation. And the reason for that is pretty logical. It's that different couples value different kind of kitchen utilities, but most of us use the bathroom in pretty much the same way. So I think that's why the bathroom remodel is such a cost-effective renovation.
With the understanding that there is a natural limit on how bathrooms get used, do you suppose this trend toward increasing bathroomification of America has a natural endpoint?
I do think that for most Americans, we have to be at peak bathroom. I mean, how many possible bathrooms could you possibly need? That said, what's happened is that bathrooms themselves have become a luxury item. So you have these houses like the new Jeff Bezos house in Washington, D.C., that has something like 25 bathrooms. For the 0.01%, they are spending down their fortunes on toilets because truly, once you have $100, $200 million, what else are you going to spend your money on?
America is overrun with bathrooms is the title of the piece in The Atlantic by Derek Thompson. Derek, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out today, possibly the most divisive topic we have ever covered on this program.
I think if someone knows there's a tall person behind them and they want to recline their seat, I think the polite thing would be to make certain it was okay.
That's Ed Bastian, the CEO of Delta Airlines, twice a guest on this program, by the way. He was on CNBC this morning talking about those carbon offsets that Megan told us about. But he was also asked about that viral video you might have seen. Somebody reclined into a guy on an American Airlines flight the other day, and he, the guy reclined into, went bananas and started punching. I mean, really punching the seat back in front of him. It was something. So what does Ed Bastian, who, by the way, is like 6'3 easy and a really big guy, what does he do?
I never recline because I don't think it's something that, since I'm the CEO of the airline, I should be reclining my seat. And I never say anything if someone reclines into me.
So you, do you recline? Do you not? Do you ask first? Hit me up on Twitter. @KaiRizdal is where I live.
All right, we got to go. Dow Industrial's off 25 today, almost a 10%. The NASDAQ picked up 19 points, 0.2%. The S&P 500 gained 6. That's about a 10% there. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Nancy Cassett is the managing director of news. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.